We're continuing our series on life, death and resurrection. We're considering tonight, as we did last week, the rather somber subject of death. And death doesn't have to be the final word in our lives, so to speak. It is the end of part of our life, but if we're a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, then we also have something else to look forward to, and that is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. Makes all the difference to me. I don't know about you, but it makes a difference to me. I want to just review a few of the passages that we looked at last week, particularly about death and life and death that we've looked at, not only last week, but in the preceding weeks. And then I'm going to invite Dave Milford and Janelle up to just give some thoughts about what they think about some of these things. The first thing I want to do is, a few times I've asked you to memorise Genesis 2 verse 7. And I wonder if you can recite Genesis 2 verse 7. The Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul or a living being, either one. It's a fundamental verse in terms of all of these things that we're talking about. That important equation is that the body of dust plus the breath of life equals a living being. And what we've talked about over the last couple of weeks is if you take one of those parts away, either the body of dust if it breaks down, or somehow the breath of life is removed, then that living being is no longer a living being. And that's a little bit of what I'd like to talk about tonight. We're going to briefly review a few passages from last week and then I'll invite the guests up. So let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 12 first. Ecclesiastes is just after the Psalms and before the major prophets. Just to remind you of some key verses. I'll read again from the NIV because I think most people have got the NIV tonight. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, and we'll just, because we're reviewing, we won't read the whole chapter, but just some of the key verses that we find in verse 6 and verse 7. These are words from the writer to encourage a person to remember the Lord and consider the Lord and the fear of the Lord before they get to a point in their life where they're unable to do that. It says, remember him before the silver cord is severed or the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring or the wheel broken at the well. And this is the point of death, and the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. So we should be remembering the Lord before we get to that point, essentially before the point of death, before we're at death's door. And of course what happens there in verse 6, we read the dust returns to the ground it came from and the spirit returns to God who gave it, which is almost the opposite of Genesis 2:7 that we all recited a moment ago, where the Lord God took the man, the dust of the ground, we took the dust of the ground and then breathed into his nostrils the breath of life and became a living being. That's just the opposite, what we read there in Ecclesiastes 12. Go back a couple of chapters now to Ecclesiastes 9. We looked at all these last week. I hope that these are just a bit of a reminder for you. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 4 we'll pick up our reading at. Anyone who is among the living has hope. And here's a wonderful sentence. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no future and no further reward, and even the memory of them is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. And to sum that up in verse 10, we have an exhortation there. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the grave, where you are going, there is neither working, nor planning, nor wisdom, nor knowledge, nor wisdom. In other words, there's no consciousness at all, no activity in the grave, which is quite contrary to what many religions and perhaps even many Christians believe, that there is life and active life after the body is gone. These verses, and we read several more last week, that talk about how there is no activity after that point of, out of that point of death. We also looked at, we won't do it now, but we also looked at Psalm 6 and Psalm 30, and these each speak of death as a complete cessation of life. And if you remember, they were also prayers of thanks to God for sparing David from his enemies and allowing him to live longer and thus to magnify the Lord. And then we also looked at Isaiah 38, which was Hezekiah, remember the Judah king, Hezekiah, his prayer of thanks because he was told that he would die, he needed to get his house in order, but then he was given a reprieve of 15 years. He was given an extra 15 years, and he offered up a prayer of thanks for being able to praise the name of the Lord for another 15 years, because if he had died then, he wouldn't have been able to do that. It's a simple statement. All right, so tonight we're going to have one more session about this subject of death, and we'll finish with a short Bible study and a little bit later tonight. But first, I think I'll invite my good friends, your friends and mine, Dave Milford and Janelle, to come up, and we'll sit around the table. And yes, oh, we've got to have the panel. So we've got to have a table. And I'm going to interview them. The last few weeks, we've looked at what's stated in Scripture about life and death. And tonight, our good friends have agreed to make a few comments about how that compares, the scriptural part, the scriptural aspect compares with what can be observed from a scientific and medical angle. Some introductions. Why did I ask Dave and Janelle? Well, Dave is a high school science teacher. I'm assuming that you teach biology, and somewhere in your teaching you're going to have to cover some aspects of human anatomy.
Yep.
And of course, life and death are all part of that. Is there anything you'd like to add before I introduce Janelle as well?
Actually, yes. I would just like to say that I reserve the right to change my opinion about anything that I say at any time without any further notice.
So. Good. So then Janelle, you know, Janelle's a registered nurse, and she's an aged care consultant and educator. She's lectured at university and TAFE level and spoken at national conferences on various subjects related to death and the dying process. And I couldn't think of a better way to say this. You'll think of a better way, but I can't think of a better way. I think it's fair to say in her 20 years of working and administering in aged care facilities, Janelle has probably witnessed the final days and ultimate deaths of more people than probably the rest of us put together. It's a sobering thought. Janelle has often come home from work and told me about her day, which for whatever reason that day wasn't so good, where she had cause to either see someone pass away or was very closely connected with someone who had just passed away. All right, thanks for agreeing to be interviewed. First question, I'm going to ask Janelle to answer this first, but Dave, I'd like you to answer as well in a moment. I'd like you to give me a quick definition of death from a medical, scientific point of view.
Well, death has three different meanings in some ways. There's the clinical death. That's where the body's system stops working. So the heart system stops working, and then the lung system stops working. So you can either have one major system stopping working, or you can have three or four happening. So this means that the person is totally unresponsive. No response at all to anything. People pinching them, people flashing things in front of their eyes, sticking things in their ears, all of those things, there's no response. There's no movement of breathing, so no breathing at all. There's no reflexes or pulses, and there's no brain activity. So that's clinical death. Legal death is when somebody certifies you as dead. Someone qualified certifies you as dead. And then there's the biological or the cellular death. That's where each individual cell of the body is dead. So it has no oxygen, no food, and no ability to get rid of any waste or reproduce itself.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that last one in a second, okay? Dave, what's your definition of death?
Definition of death is obviously when life ceases, but you know, in science we talk about the seven different criteria that have to be satisfied for something to be, you know, classified as living. And I won't bore you with all of those, but they include such things as the ability to assimilate, which means, you know, take in nutrients and make them part of themselves, to reduce wastes, to respond to their environment, which, you know, all living things do. Produce waste, I think I might have said that one, but and to reproduce, some of those examples. So if something is dead, it can't do those things that scientists have actually come up with, the seven criteria.
So does it have to fulfil all seven?
It does, yep. If it doesn't fulfil all seven, it's classified as non-living or dead.
Six is not enough.
Six is not enough, yep. And I would agree with what you were saying as well about how there are possibly different levels of death. And I think it all just depends on someone's opinion as well, because I haven't experienced as many dying people as you or dead people, but for instance, you might find that someone has no pulse and someone might actually declare them as being dead, but yet at the same time they may be able to be revived. And so there the question springs up in my mind is, well, were they really dead, or were they just having a long period of time between heartbeats? They just needed a little bit of a kickstart to keep it going.
All right, we'll talk about that in a moment. We'll definitely get onto that.
Oh, yeah.
Because I want to get back to that point about people who've been resuscitated and everything. Both of you mentioned in your answers about there being perhaps different levels of death. The question I gave you in the week was, is death a process or is it an event? So is there a point of death we can say that person is dead, or does it take time? Are there stages? Janelle?
This is hard because for most people, people would see the death of that person as an event. That person died. But in fact, death is a process, because while you might have that cardiac arrest that stops your system working and your brain activity goes to nothing, you know, like you have no brain activity, your body, parts of your body still live, although they cannot respond to the environment or make you alive again.
So I think when we were talking about this through the week, you were saying, so a person might be in a point where they haven't got a pulse, they can't breathe, they don't respond to pinching or yelling or anything like that, but their hair still might grow for a few days and their nails might still grow for a few days. Is that the sort of thing you mean?
So on a cellular level, there's oxygen trapped in the body and in the bloodstream and around each living cell or each cell, and that cell can still be alive and stay living until the oxygen has evaporated, until the food has gone, and until the cell can't get rid of its waste. So that can be 5 to 6 days after the point of death. And in some cases, people have been known to have grown hair and grown nails for quite considerable amount of time, sometimes up to a month after they have died. So all that means is that those cells down here in your cuticle have just got a great blood supply and have been able to maintain themselves in that environment. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden they're going to stand up again and say, I'm back. That's not going to happen.
Because all the other things...
The system is dead.
Right. Dave, process or event?
Well, I think once again it's actually both. I think that when someone dies finally, you know, most people would actually look at that and say that that is an event. But I think it's a process, and I think that's what you were saying as well, because I think that ultimately from the point of conception, that the parts are put in place to actually lead to your demise. You know, the molecules and radiation and so on start to interfere with your chromosomes, leading to degradation, and ultimately that's how the aging process is believed to occur. You've still got the same chromosomes that you're actually, or copies thereof, the chromosomes you actually started out with, but throughout your life, of how long it is. There's been chemicals and radiation sort of leading to their destruction, and consequently we all end up looking a little bit wrinkly and so on as we get older, and eventually things stop working. So I think it's definitely a process. Starts from the instant egg and sperm actually meet, but at the same time I think that most people would actually look at it as an event when it actually finally does occur. I think it's both.
Okay, so you're saying that life includes various stages of death? Death events or deaths of cells?
I think that you start dying from the instant that you are in fact classified as being alive. So from the instant of conception, I think you start to die.
Part of you is dying. I mean, you have a baby who's this big, but then there are parts, say cells that die or however.
Cells.
Okay, right, so they die. But then that person still grows.
Yes. Yeah. So what is basically happening is that there is the multiplication of the cell. So it's, the organism is growing from one cell to trillions of cells. But I think that throughout this whole process, there is the degradation of the quality of those cells. Because they start out as being the highest quality. That's when you have the egg and the sperm first combined, and you are just a single-celled organism, because everyone ever started from just one cell. But from that point where that one cell turns into two, and then the two turn into four, and so on and so on and so on, until you get to the point where you are today with trillions of cells, every time there is this division process where there is a copy of the copy, it's always degrading. So therefore, from that very first moment, it's getting worse. It's like a photocopy. If you get this piece of paper that I've scribbled on with David's questions, you stick it into a photocopier, and we get the copy, and then I stick that onto the photocopier and press copy. And then I get the copy that I've just made and stick it onto the photocopier and press copy, and keep on doing this process time after time after time. The end product that I end up having after 100 gazillion copies, is it better or worse than the one that I started out?
It's going to be worse.
It's worse, and that's what's happening with us. So,
do you think that if sin had not entered, do you think that that applies to Adam as well?
Had sin not entered, I do not think it would have been relevant, because I think that part of the curses, as we call it, is that some of this sustaining power has been removed, and so therefore there is this state of decay that has been allowed to occur. I don't believe necessarily God is making it happen, I just think it's allowed to occur.
Some of you will know Arthur Custance, who has written from an anthropological point of view, and he's a Christian author, deceased now, but a Christian author with a science background. And he would put it in that sense of dying, thou shalt die. So the curse that was given, or the if you want to call it a promise, the threat in the Genesis 2:17, don't touch the tree, because in the day that you do, dying you shall die. And his understanding of that is just what you're talking about, that degradation. He still lived to be 930 years, so he's obviously had a better gene pool than we do. But is that something along the same lines?
That's absolutely what I was thinking. Yeah.
Right, okay.
I think the other thing about that is that there was an introduction, a lot more introduction of disease into the gene pool. If you're going to be Adam and you're going to live forever, of course you didn't eat the fruit, which is, I know it's hypothetical, but with sin came the introduction of disease. That's when people started to die, and the disease is what degradates the gene pool. So that's why we have things, like genetic disorders, that sort of thing, because there's a degradation. But also, just in our lifestyle, we degradate our cells and our
our environment is not 100% healthy. That reminds me of when you were talking about that, of Romans 6:23. We've mentioned it a few times. The wages of sin is death, or the consequences of sin is death. It's very real, isn't it? There's something very physical about it too. All right. Now, one of the questions I've asked Dave and Janelle to consider begins with this. It begins with one of the verses we looked at. Ecclesiastes 12:7 mentions that at death, the spirit returns to God who gave it. At the point of death, if the spirit returns to God who gave it, what do you think is actually happening here? You might want to touch on what you think the breath of life is, or the spirit in this case. What do you think is happening?
Well, for me, the life force here that we're talking about, or the breath, or the spirit if you like, does return to God.
Is that what was breathed into Adam, you think?
I think it is.
Okay.
It's the same stuff. We we need to see that it was much more than oxygen that was breathed into Adam. If it was only oxygen, we'd technically be able to save everybody's life if we just had to feed oxygen into them. But I think it's more like the initiation of life. So things like the sparking of the messages that run down your central nervous system, so that the messages can pass up and down your spinal column and to all the parts of your body. So if you want to wriggle your big toe, it takes a lightning fast message from your brain to your big toe to wiggle it. And when you want to stop wiggling, you also need another message. So those things happen, you know, at a hugely or a very rapid rate that we could never do with just having the building blocks without that initiation. Also things like the enzyme activity in each living cell, how it breathes, how it feeds itself, how it gets rid of its waste. You can you could create a cell with all those components in it, but until you have that initiation, there's no life. If the cell's just been made by us, there's really no life in it until that initiation happens.
Would you say it's of divine origin or supernatural origin?
There is nothing that human beings have created without a living cell. And the only living cells...
You mean no live thing?
No live thing, right, without a living cell. The only living cells that we have are the ones that God initiated. It's sort of like this Frankenstein story. You know, the Frankenstein story says, oh, we're going to make this man and he's going to live. There's been nothing ever made by human beings that is living, even though they have all the building blocks and all the components to do it, unless there's a live piece of live tissue there. And that's why I think that God initiated that.
So when the scientists cloned Dolly the sheep, they had to start off with something that was alive first.
That's right. Can't do it from dead cells. Death creates death, and life creates life.
Dave, any thoughts?
I think that this is very difficult for me to answer because... from my understanding of the scriptures, which is limited, of course.
We're all limited.
That's right. Yeah. But I kind of wonder if the spirit that we have is in fact individualistic or whether it's just general. And I can't help but wonder if perhaps the spirit that we have, this life force, it is definitely coming from God. There is no question about that. And it cannot be explained without God. I'm not talking about complete humanism or purely naturalistic processes. But I think that every living thing, whether it be a slug or a human being or anything in between, has this life force. Okay, it cannot exist without it.
But and it came from God originally?
It came from God.
Right.
You know, all life has to come from God. But you know, I cannot help but wonder if, and I was talking to Janelle about this a few weeks ago, that if we had some kind of three-dimensional camera that could take a snapshot of any one of us at any instant whilst we're living. So, you know, we'll take you for instance, David, and let's say we take a 3D snapshot of you, and it's so detailed that we can actually place every single atom in exactly the right place. So let's imagine we had the technology and a tiny pair of tweezers so that we could actually just piece by piece actually put a replica of David Tavender over here. So, you know, if we look down at the bottom of his toe, for instance, to start there, and we could find the appropriate atoms, not only the appropriate atoms, but put the electrons in exactly the same spot that they were in David Tavender at this snapshot that we took of him. And we held them there, and, like, we cannot do this. This is all hypothetical, but I cannot help but wonder if we had every single piece in the same position, if we could then snap the fingers and it actually be alive. Now, I know this is going to cause some eyebrows to rise at such a concept, but I'm not actually talking about something that can exist apart from God, because I would actually say that this pen is held together by, you know, strong and weak nuclear forces, and there is electrostatic attraction between different particles and everything, but a lot of people look at that and they say, well, this is just naturalistic. We don't need God for that. That is complete and utter rubbish. No one, no scientist with a very big brain can actually explain in any meaningful way to himself or to anyone else how it is that a positive and negative particle will actually attract to each other. They know that they do, They can tell you some things about, you know, the strength of these forces and so on, but they can't tell you why. The same as they can't actually tell you why it is that right now gravity is sucking you to your seat and you are sucking the seat to yourself, because you guys actually have gravity as well and no one knows why. It's just magic. And so,
so the scriptures talk about how by Christ, by him, all things consist.
Yes.
Is that, that is, the principle you're talking about?
Absolutely. Mm. And God is actually allowing or making this table hold together. Without God, it could not happen.
He's established the laws that govern the universe and the physics and everything that makes it all happen.
Not only has he just established the laws, but I feel as though he maintains them. Without him actually looking upon everything in whatever way, I cannot explain it, but if he didn't look upon everything in a particular way, everything would just disintegrate. It would fall apart. I feel that is how it all operates. So therefore, I cannot help but wonder if life as it is like a big machine. And once again, I'm not looking at it as a completely humanistic, naturalistic process. I'm talking about a big machine that was initially set up with energy and atoms in the appropriate places. And this is God breathing the energy of life, you know, the life force into things, and then letting them go, standing back. And so all the pieces are falling down, falling down, falling down. We're getting through the years until we, and you know, people come and go, they live and they die. And this is all of God's energy and spirit going through everything to make it live, by living things, not tables, of course. But until eventually we die, you know, the energy, which is the life force, passes through us. Things wear out as a result of, you know, a limited amount of life force being allowed into us, because God, as a result of the curse, he's, you know, turned away to a degree and things have been allowed to degrade. But I think that ultimately this energy or the spirit is returning to God, and we see that not only in the form of death, but also just in nature as things are wearing down.
Okay, so we've talked about the spirit returning to God. I think I know what Janelle's view is on this, so I'll just preempt this a little bit. But I think you would say that you believe that life began with Adam, mm-hmm. or human life began with Adam,
yes.
which was then transformed to Eve.
Yep.
So God didn't have to sort of, well, she was a pretty miraculous creation, I suppose.
Yeah. But she was living tissue.
That's right. So when they had Cain and Abel,
yep.
God didn't give them another boost as such. Adam and Eve passed on their living, the living force through them into Cain and Abel, who then passed it on to their descendants, and so on down to us.
And I would have a slightly different view today in the fact that I would say that that thing that happened to Adam when he was created is degrading, but it is still a very pure essence of life force. Because if it was degrading down, we would be seeing a lot more genetic mutation, a lot more problems than we actually do. Most of those sorts of things, while they're still present, they've always been present.
Is that more to do with the body of dust, the information that's passed on the body of dust, rather than the breath of life?
I think it's got to do with the genetic purity of Adam and Eve. The fact that
isn't that the body of dust?
Yes, it is. But I think it's the purity of the dust and the breath together. The dust is
well, the
dead.
Body,
yeah, the body is dead until the breath of life comes. So with those two things together, I think that's where you get the pure, the good genes from, the good genetic material. And over time, you know, certainly we've had more diseases being apparent, but they've always been there. That disease has always been there. Diabetes has been with us forever. We just discovered it in 1908. Heart disease has always been there. We just didn't.
Yeah, we can analyse it now.
Yeah.
Want to add anything to that before we move on, Dave?
I'd actually say that the life force, if you like, the sustaining power of God has been fairly consistent since the curse. And I would say that we're living shorter lifespans simply because...
So not before the curse?
No,
since the curse?
Yeah, that's right. I think before the curse, you know, God's sustaining power and so on was such that things were not going to decay. But I think that since then, you know, just speaking in a figurative sort of sense, God has turned away to a degree, and as a result, things are starting to fall apart. And I think that people are accumulating more genetic errors over time. and then parents pass those on to their children, and they pass them on to their children. So I think that the how did you refer to it before, this purity?
The gene pool, the genetic purity.
Yeah, I think it's definitely decaying.
Okay, all right. Well, that's good to have dissension among the ranks. Keeps it interesting. I think you're actually saying very similar things from what I'm hearing.
I don't know if it could happen, but I would not say that it definitely couldn't happen, that if in time scientists could actually bring a simple organism to life, like a
from death, from nothing, from lifelessness.
From just chemicals that do not necessarily have to come from something that was living before.
Okay, all right, thanks. Three thoughts. I'd like to move on to another question now. I gave you this question too, so I'll just read it for everyone who hasn't read it. I recently saw a TV program where a swimmer was dragged unconscious from the surf by a lifesaver. And he was said to have, quote, died four times in 20 minutes. And then he was brought back to life again and he survives today. All right. Did he really die? Janelle?
That's very convenient and very sensational for the media and other people to say that they've been brought back to life again. It's very convenient. But there are reasons why somebody would look dead and look like they were revived or brought back to life. I believe that when this happens, this, you know, bringing back to life, that the body hasn't lost its life force. I think there are several things that can go wrong in the body, but they are not technically dead. The things that can happen is a systems failure where one of your vital systems, like your heart or your lungs or your blood pressure or your sensations, can actually be impaired by whatever's happened to you. But those systems are still working. They may be only working in a small way, but...
So they're damaged or they're being hindered, but they're not fully functioning.
Not fully functioning. And so what happens is the body pumps out a whole lot of adrenaline, and the adrenaline kick-starts that process again by all sorts of means. It's like a shock treatment for the body.
That often has to be promoted by, say, a lifesaver or someone else administering first aid.
When they're doing those cardiac compressions, they are not bringing your heart back to life. They are just pushing the oxygen through your system so your brain stays alive. What happens in those situations is because your brain's still alive, because we're doing the...
That was a pushing down moment.
when they're doing that, then your brain makes a new pathway down to that heart and says, for goodness sake, start up again. And that's what it does. It's got nothing to do with that person. Most first aiders couldn't find the heart if somebody read their chest open and choked. We just haven't got that ability. The only people who can really do that are the very schmick paramedics, and I'm not even sure GPs can do it successfully, but cardiac specialists are probably the other ones who do it.
And
defibrillators?
Yeah.
What the defibrillators do is that once they've put the paddles on, you know, that's where they put the paddles on and shock the heart again, all they're doing is making the electrical pattern come through a different way from their medulla oblongata down here in their brain stem, to that heart and getting that heart moving again.
So it's like an electrical impulse?
Like an electrical stun gun. Boom to the heart and the heart will start pumping.
So there must have been some potential. I'll get to you in a sec, Dave, because I want to get your opinion about this as well. But there must have been something in the heart that is perhaps damaged or is being hindered, but it still has enough ability in itself with a bit of help, bit of a jolt, to start again.
Yes. And all the rest of the body systems are still working.
But the person didn't die.
But they look like they're dying
because
their heart stops. When your heart stops, you go, bleh. The defibrillator gives you a shock, and then that heart system, in connection with your brain and your heart, will start working again. That doesn't mean you've lost your life force. We know lots of people who die, boom, cardiac arrest, the whole of their heart muscle dies, they're dead before they hit the floor. And no amount of cardiac massage or no amount of any life-saving stuff is going to help them. They've gone. They've just died.
Okay.
But other people in that situation who are, you know, died four times in the ambulance, they're not dead. They've just got a system not working properly.
It's being severely hindered somehow. Okay, I want to talk to you about one of your residents in a moment too. But Dave, so we were talking about the lifesaver. Did that person really die four times and come back?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd agree with Janelle and say that no, they're not really dead. I think that, you know, some people whose definition of death is just when there is cardiac arrest, and, you know, it's convenient for them to say that they're dead. But in reality, I don't think so. And I think that there's been numerous examples throughout the world, and it sounds like you've actually experienced several of these yourself, where there have been people that have been classified as being dead and have been brought back to life after 45 minutes of cardiac arrest. And I can remember even reading in one of the most reliable sources, which was the Reader's Digest magazine one time, a boy who was skating on a lake, and there was a soft patch in the ice, went through, was underneath, and, you know, his friends were there with their hockey sticks trying to crack through the ice to pull him out, and he was just there, just looking up at them. And 45 minutes later, they eventually get a tow truck or something down, I think it was, and they crack through the ice with the hook and tow him up, and, you know, he'd been dead for 45 minutes, but yet, as a result of being cool, you know, there was something to kickstart him, you know, I need someone doing a bit of CPR or whatever, he came back to life. So
his system, you think his system slowed down?
Just slowed down, yeah. And I think that, you know, had there not been any intervention, that obviously that would have been the end of it for him. But, yeah, I don't think that that person was completely dead. And it's interesting, too, when you hear about stories of people who are classified as being dead, once again, because they don't have a pulse rate, but they do actually recall things that have actually happened during this period of time. And, you know, I think this is some of these near-death experiences where people have been in the operating theatre or whatever, and they've, you know, their heart has stopped and they've recalled conversations or something that have actually occurred.
So the doctors and nurses are talking amongst themselves they've heard this conversation, they've taken it and they can recall it, but of course they couldn't respond to it at the time.
That's right. Yeah, and I think that, you know, they're probably just still alive and their brain chemistry is just still ticking over and they're listening and possibly even thinking. And I know there's even been accounts of people that have been in car accidents and they've had this thing happen and they've been classified as dead, but something has happened 10 minutes later and they've, you know, recalled what it was that the paramedics and someone were doing around, you know, just ignoring them because they thought that they were dead. So,
So obviously that life force hasn't left them.
No.
They're not dead.
Well, I want to just come back to Janelle now because she's told me about one of her residents that, you know, Madge. I want you to tell us about Madge and she had a particular syndrome.
I had a resident who had a syndrome. She's now passed away. She really is dead now. Called Stokes-Adams. And Stokes-Adams is a condition where people appear to be dead. They have an incredibly low pulse rate, sometimes only four pulses in a minute. Their respiration becomes so light that you can't actually visibly see any change in their chest and you can't feel anything. They're unresponsive, unconscious to the point of being unresponsive. And it's not a particularly common thing to happen, but it has been known to happen. And Madge used to do this quite often because of the condition that she had. She had a lot of brain damage. She'd had several strokes, a lot of cognitive problems, and she used to just fall into this state.
She'd be conscious as we are and then flop, or what would she do?
She'd be eating tea or lunch or whatever, sitting in the sunshine, and she would just drop. And you'd be, because she was in a wheelchair, she'd just go. So you'd pick her up and you'd race her down to a room, get her onto the bed, you know, whatever you're going to do, check her out. And one of the things that particularly happened with her, and you could look at her, and I'd had ambulance people come in saying, she's dead. Because, you know, we'd have myself and a carer there. She's dead. She's not dead. She's got Stokes-Adams. Oh, I know, she's dead. Look at her. She's dead. She's grey. She's dead. She's got nothing. She's, you know. And you'd go, breathe, Madge. And she'd go,
no, here.
And they'd go, meow, out the door. They'd run like the clappers. And they'd say, what happened then? But that was the process that she had.
You actually had to tell her, didn't you? You actually yelling, but breathe.
You used to have to get into her ear and say, breathe, Madge. And she would let out this, you know, or inhale this thing. It was very wet and it was, you know, not like a normal breath that we had. But it used to scare everybody to death.
Mm.
Except
Madge.
So these are the people that you hear of periodically who sit up at their funerals. Go, hello. What am I doing in here? They have no idea where they've been because their level of consciousness is so poor that they don't know. They can do what Dave is saying and hear everything that you've said. So, you know, when you've talked about your horrible mother-in-law over a coffin, they often know. Because hearing is the last sense to go.
Mm. And essentially, in both of these cases, the guy who was pulled from the surf and the lady with Stokes Adams and maybe perhaps the guy who was also pulled from the ice there, they've just slowed down, haven't they? Is that what you're saying? They've just everything's just very, very slow, but there's still a spark of life there.
One system has stopped or they have slowed right down.
Actually, just something else. I can remember reading years ago. I believe there was a chap that back in the days when they were doing the headings, you know, taking people's heads off when they did something nasty, there was some chap that actually went to some individuals that were about to have their head lopped off and said, look, you mind if I use you for an experiment? Two blinks for a yes, one blink for a no, and I want to see if you can actually answer some of the questions after you've had your head lopped off. But apparently, there were some chaps that could actually do the two blinks or something or other for a small period of time afterwards.
What would you call a small period of time?
I believe it was just in a matter of minutes, you know, 5 minutes or so. I think that, you know, the oxygen wasn't circulating properly and it certainly would have been fading off, conscious at all. But there's the possibility, maybe, that they could have actually done this.
Hmm.
And given that their adrenaline would have been pumping through their system if somebody's got that thing hanging over their head, they'd have had a lot of adrenaline, therefore a lot of blood supply to their brain, because the brain's in panic mode. So a lot of oxygen's in there, a lot of food. So that brain may not have died straight away, because those cells are getting blood and food and pouring out the waste as quickly as they can. Can I just say, categorically, none of those people who had died and came back to life were dead and brought back to life. They were in a state where the body's... There's something terribly wrong with the body, but they are not dead.
Were they in the process?
I think they were probably what you would call clinical death situation, or the first stage.
Well, there was no response, no pulse, no breathing.
Yeah, one or the other.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And then the adrenaline kicks in, the body rallies, the chemicals start shooting through their body and they stay alive. But sometimes it's an each-way bet.
Okay. All right, well, as you can see, there's a lot we can talk about. We're not going to take too much more time. I'd still like to just give it a little short Bible study. But if there is one question, and I think Athol had his hand up first, I would really like to just keep this to about 5 minutes if we can.
Going back to the situation with Adam, and you're talking about the purity before the fall and all that type of thing. Given that, then, how do you explain the provision of the tree of life, which was there for their use before the fall? Because once they fell, God said, no, you can't go anywhere near the tree of life. So what?
Maybe that tree of life had some properties to keep that purity pure. Maybe was a test.
That wasn't the test, was it?
But the purity could be provided either directly or indirectly. It's still provided by God. So it can be via invisible means, or it could be via this tree.
Do you think the tree of life was there in case of accidental death?
It would have been.
Or
the knowledge
or injury. I can imagine the very man that's got no experience of anything in climbing a tree could cause a few accidents okay. himself, and he wouldn't imagine that it might happen. The same as does what we do. We still wouldn't be one person in this room with all the knowledge we've got who hasn't taken a chance and
done something silly. Mm. Okay.
As life has gone on, it's become less pure.
The genetic information is.
So you're saying 1,000 years after Adam, the human race was less pure?
No, more.
Purer.
Than today? What are you referring to today, or to Adam?
From Adam.
Okay, from Adam it was the genetic, the gene pool, if you like, was more degraded 1,000 years after Adam.
So we're much more degraded than what Adam and Israel.
Yeah, and I think to an extent that might actually explain why it is that we don't live as long as what they were back then too.
So Noah lived to be 700.
Well, I think you'll find that God actually sets the age of 120 years.
Yeah, I've actually read that, but I don't know that that is necessarily the case, because it says 120 years, and if you look at people directly after that statement, some of them are still living more than 120 years, I think.
I think Jacob was about 137.
Yeah, I think that that statement has to be interpreted some other way. And I have actually heard a good argument as to how it could be interpreted, and I can't for the life of me remember right.
Yeah, one of the views is that God was saying about Adam, my spirit will not strive with him, Adam, not mankind in general, but Adam, forever. He only has another 120 years to live.
Mm.
Yeah. Not a general statement about the
humanity in general.
Yes, lifespan. All right, well, thanks very much. There's a lot more that we could talk about, but thanks very much for agreeing to be a part of tonight. Thank you. That was really terrific. Thanks, Dave and Janelle. Very interesting. Maybe just one final comment. The world doesn't make sense without the scriptures, and if the scriptures don't measure up with what we see, then of course people are going to be questioning. Well, what I've sort of tried to do tonight anyway is just show that there's some scientific evidence to suggest that what we see around us is actually justified by scripture too, and the two match up. They're not at loggerheads. Science and the Bible are not at loggerheads. They're complementary. That's how I see it anyway. I hope you do too.